Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audible.com/Carlin, that's audible.com/Carlin, or text Carlin to 500500 to get started. I've just heard the audio that you're about to hear, and this is my own critique of the audio that you're about to hear, and it's a little redundant only because I actually start off the program with a little bit of that sort of talk too, so I apologize for the redundancy. But I'm going to call this episode, I'm going to throw in nightmare somehow, because it sounds like a nightmare, and I don't just mean because of the material, which is nightmarish. Nothing new about that, of course, on, you know, what we do. But almost my recounting of it is like that, like you woke up in the middle of the night, you know, screaming, and the next morning your spouse says to you, what the heck was that all about? And you try to recount, you know, what happened to you in your nightmare, and it always sounds like a bunch of disjointed, flashing images. You know, we always like to try to put a little artistic touch or a little flair here or there with the big hardcore history shows. And I feel like that's what's missing in the audio that you're going to hear now. It sounds like a nightmare. It sounds like I'm just telling you the highlights or worst moments or the things that freaked me out the most or whatever is sticking in my memory after going back to sleep in the middle of the night. But for some of you, especially, I think, you know, those of you who already know some of this or all of this story, it will remind you once again that, you know, if I'm recounting a nightmarish sort of story to you, I mean, think about how many people actually woke up in the night for many, many, many decades after this event with this exact same nightmare. And it's pretty safe to say that unlike me, who wasn't there, the people who were there would probably be unable to tell anyone else who wasn't there, you know, what they were seeing in their dreams. So apologies for the lack of artistic flair in what you're going to hear now, but, you know, welcome to a nightmare of the Indianapolis.
It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
I've tried to think about what the difference between one of these hardcore history addendums and one of the larger hardcore history shows is. I mean, what's the difference between the two of them? Besides, obviously, that we're doing some interviews. But I thought, you know, there's a whole bunch of great stories out there, and I write them down. You know, whenever I think of one, I put it in a book so that, you know, someday when I don't have enough ideas, there's a bunch already down. I know a lot of you do this too. And a bunch of these ideas are not worth a whole history show, or you can't do a whole history show. I mean, I'd love to do something, and I've wanted to do something for a long time, on the ancient Egyptian neighbor known as Kush, the Kushites, but there's no primary source material. I mean, it's one of those things where you just can't hang a whole show on what you have to work with. There's a lot of stories like that. The one today is like that. I mean, there is actually enough material to do a whole big four-hour thing on this subject, but it would get repetitive, and it would get repetitive in a way that makes the First World War program we did, which was pretty repetitive in terms of, you know, ongoing horror, it would make that seem a little tame, because at a certain point in this story, there's nothing but that. And it's psychological torture after a certain amount of time. And so it's hard to not get gratuitous, or it's hard to not just get redundant at a certain point. You want to be able to say to the audience, and there's just more of that, and you know what that's like. I thought about talking about this because I caught really the tail end the other night of a movie that's underrated, although when I went online to do some more modern research on it, I was surprised to find that it is considered kind of an artistic classic now. It's one of Steven Spielberg's really early movies. It's Jaws. I think it came out in like 1975. I was 10. And I can tell you that it was a huge event and sort of an unexpected one. There'd been a novel that had done pretty well, but the novel was very different than the movie. And the movie, as all, I think, really great films do, has a number of really fine actors in it. And you give those people a really fine script. And I guess there was a significant amount of improvisation from time to time that made it into the final version that the actors did. But you remember who was in that. I mean, Roy Scheider, who was great. You had Richard Dreyfuss, who was still great. And my God, you had Robert Shaw, who was unbelievable in that role, I mean, among others. And you get the three of them at certain points in the story, and they're just in the cabin I mean, there's no scenery, there's no movement really of the cameras. It's just those three actors working a fine script, and at one point, Robert Shaw goes into a monologue, and it's incredible from a appreciating the craft standpoint. Those of you who remember, though, the monologue, it has to do with the character that Robert Shaw is playing in his past. He's playing sort of an old sea dog kind of fisherman who's going to catch this shark, and he knows a lot about sharks. And he goes into the background, and it turns out he was on the USS Indianapolis. And those of you who know that story know how that's connected to sharks. And so I'm watching this, the tail end, like I said, of Jaws the other night, and I just thought, you know, the Indianapolis is an amazing story. And it typifies where sort of some of my interests tend to lean, as you all know. I always like to say, maybe it's a nice way of saying it, that I'm into the extremes of the human experience, but some people think I'm just into war and this and violence. And, you know, it's funny. Sometimes I'll read accounts from like 100 years ago. There's a famous one from a German general named von Moltke, where he talks about sort of the reasons you wouldn't want to go too long between wars, because it brings out something in the human character. And he's not talking about the low-level side, you know, the killing of your fellow man and butchery. He's talking about sort of the higher side of the human experience. And it's weird to think about that. See, I don't agree with him about that. I'm not going there. But the story of the Indianapolis is a perfect example of something where it only happens because of war, but what happens after the sinking of the ship, the famous sinking of the ship, is one of these tales where, I mean, it sends tears down your face, and not just because of the human suffering, but because of the human reaction to the suffering, right? That it was kind of those higher qualities that von Moltke was sort of referring to. When you see people under amazing amounts of physical and psychological pressure with fellow human beings, and how they act in situations that are far more stressful than what one could be expected to reasonably handle. The Indianapolis combines a number of things which would make my top 10 list of worst nightmares, wrap them all into one wonderful package. If you are a fan of disaster movies, not to compare this to a disaster movie, no offense, family members of Indianapolis survivors or not survivors. But I mean, think, you know, my mom was in a movie once that was a knockoff of The Towering Inferno. So Burning Building, that's a disaster movie. You hang a whole movie on that. And you have something like The Poseidon Adventure or Titanic, which is a disaster movie of a ship sinking at sea. You hang a whole movie on that. There are, I mean, each segment and phase in the Indianapolis story is one of those disaster films. And by the time the story's over, and is the story ever really over? You know, these people, it's like these people went from the Towering Inferno, hopped on board the Titanic. I mean, just one thing after another. And I don't mean to make light of it, because when you read the accounts of what these people went through, and then you sort of magnify it, because what they went through is not that uncommon in human history. They're not like these real outliers. It's uncommon for you and me to have gone through it, but how many mariners over the waves, over the eras, have had their ships sink and gone through the terrible things that that involves, and then had to deal with some of the subsidiary things that all of the people who went in the water with the Indianapolis had to deal with. So in a funny way, this is a kind of common, uncommon human experience, if you will. But the Indianapolis' story is, it's got its own twists. In this case, if you don't know it, let me fill you in for a minute. And I don't know how well this is going to work in short form, because you know that's not my normal genre. But the Indianapolis is famously known. It's a USS Portland-class cruiser, heavy cruiser. Heavy cruisers generally mean, you know, bigger, more armor, bigger guns. So in the United States Navy in the Second World War, if it had 6-inch guns, it was probably a light cruiser. If it had 8-inch guns, it was probably a heavy cruiser. About 10,000 tons, big ship. I don't know, between 600 and 700 feet long. And in this case, the Indianapolis is famous because it delivered some of the key components, you know, to an island in the Pacific that would be put together and made into the first atomic bomb. But because of that, it was a secret mission, and people weren't really in the know about the comings and the goings of the Indianapolis, perhaps as well as they should have been aware of it. And this kind of plays into the story in a pretty big way. Because after delivering the components to the island of Tinian, this Indianapolis, Portland-class heavy cruiser goes off on its merry way, kind of towards the Philippines, I think it was, and in the night gets torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. Now, this is in 1945. I think it's July. So it's, you know, we are not that far from the end of the war at all. I mean, as we said, they're kind of putting the parts together for the Hiroshima bomb, so not that far away from the end of the war. But now you get to the first level of this disaster that these Indianapolis folks have to deal with. Imagine being asleep in your bunk at night on a ship and two torpedoes slam into it. One slammed into the bow at the front of the ship, one slammed sort of amidships but a little forward. Survivors' accounts. And by the way, you want to read a good book on this. Let me just break into this for a minute. I really loved In Harm's Way by Doug Stanton, although there are several books on the Indianapolis. I'm going to quote a couple of pieces from Stanton's book, but if you think this story is interesting and you want to get the real feel for it, he does a great job, I think. But Stanton talks about, you know, when the two torpedoes hit, he's talking to a survivor that was sort of in the front of the ship, and he was asleep in his bunk in one of these, you know, sort of ship rooms that they had that you probably have 6, 8, 10 guys, and the bunks are stacked against the wall. And when the torpedoes hit, the survivor says the lights go out and all the bunks fall and everybody's in a pile of people and some have broken arms and ribs and everybody, of course, woken up from a deep sleep. You're totally confused. And with the lights out, it's, you know, extra bad. So immediately this ship starts having problems. And so the crew starts doing the typical things you do to try to, you know, prevent the ship from sinking. And one of the things you do is you start walling off the compartments that are damaged and flooding. Dogging things down is the way Stanton has the Navy guys describing it in the book. But the problem with that is if you're cutting off compartments that are flooding, what do you do with the people that are still in the flooding compartments, right? So the first thing that just horrifies you in this story of the Indianapolis going down at night in the tropical waters sort of east of the Philippines is that you have these sailors who have to cut their own shipmates off in flooding compartments. And Stanton says you can hear him scream, you know, don't leave us here. I mean, what are you supposed to do? So right there you get, you know, want to talk human experiences that are extreme and that are already larger than most of us will ever face. In the first 5 minutes of this disaster, there are guys dealing with things that are going to haunt their memories the rest of their lives. And the affair is hardly started. You know, when you talk about the human capacity for endurance, survival, and not just survival through the event, but then to be able to live with it, you know, afterwards. And by the way, the guy who was the captain of the Indianapolis made it about 20 years afterwards. He'll survive the whole thing, but he'll kill himself. Still getting Christmas cards from people who say, and I'm quoting one here, "Merry Christmas. Our family's holiday would be a lot merrier if you hadn't killed my son." Stanton says that the captain, a guy named McVeigh, would keep all of these letters and put them, you know, with a ribbon around them and keep them in his desk, blaming himself always for what happened on that dark night. But on this ship, these people that survive will talk about seeing him, you know, running around this sinking ship as it starts to take on water. And by the way, they have 12 minutes between the time the torpedoes strike till the time it goes down. And once again, the idea of having a between 600 and 700 foot long, 10,000 ton ship begin to disintegrate out from under you and go underwater as the waves begin rolling people off the deck is crazy also. So now, right away, we're at like the second stage. So you had to cut your seamen off and dog down into the compartments and consign them to certain death so the rest of the ship might survive. Now you're dealing with the mental image of the ship starting to go down by the bow that's in the front, and the stern starts to slowly rise out of the, I mean, the ship is going perpendicular and people are dropping off. And Stanton describes survivors saying people will jump off and hit the rudders. People will jump off and hit the propellers that are still spinning and be launched off into space. Once again, how do you even in 12 minutes or less really process all this? And it's dark, and people are freaking out. I mean, this is like a giant accident scene right away. There's like between 11 and 1,200 guys on this ship, and more than 300 are going to die in the first 12 minutes. And so you're watching all this happening, and many of these people now are grievously wounded. Stanton, one of the main survivors, he talks about in this thing. I mean, the first thing he hears when he recovers from hearing the torpedo hits is somebody screaming in the compartment next door. And he runs over there, realizes it's his friend, the dentist, but he can't open the door because the whole thing's on fire and he just has to let him burn to death in the first 2 minutes. And then he burns his hand because the ship itself is turning red hot. He puts his hands on the deck or on a rail, boom, he's got burned hands. And then as the ship starts to go kind of perpendicular, he tells the story about they have a bunch of wounded people, I guess, in the sick bay, but they're on cots and they're tied to their beds and whatnot. And he says they just all slide right into the sea. And he's sitting there watching this happen, slack-jawed. I read a book a while back, and it's about how people react in disasters. Trying to remember what it was, like if the worst should occur or something like that. I think we talked about it once. But it's by one of these experts who studies these things. And one of the things that they said is in situations like this, right, plane crashes or shipwrecks or whatnot, most people are like stunned into numbness. They don't do anything, right? In some of these bad plane crashes, everybody could have gotten out, but they sat there and burned to death, you know, on the tarmac. That's shocking, but that's what you would expect to happen on a ship like this. And yet, maybe it's the military training. Who knows? Maybe it's the fact you have officers barking out orders, but you're not seeing a ton of that. You are seeing people jumping in the water as fast as they can go because they're all afraid of the same thing. When a big ship goes down, it sucks stuff down with it a lot of the time. It creates a vacuum that can drown swimmers who are anywhere nearby. So everyone knows if the ship's going down, you got to get as far away from it as possible. It's like, you know, when you get into an auto wreck and you're worried that the gasoline's leaking and the car is going to catch on fire, you want to get far away from it. Well, when the ship goes down, it's going to suck everything down with it. And several of the survivors, once again, imagine this. One of them talks about having it feel as though somebody was yanking his foot and his shoe came off. And all of a sudden, with a life vest, he went way underwater to where his ears are popping and his eyes feel like they're going to, you know, pop out of his head. And then he said he got caught in a giant air bubble, you know, that escaped from the sinking ship. And it goes, pops him up and shoots him up. He said 3 feet into the air before he came down again in an absolutely pitch black ocean, covered as far as the eye could see, if it could see in the dark, with a 2-inch thick molasses-like consistency oil spill from the ship that is burning the eyes and coating all of these men. And if you ever look at photographs of people being rescued from, like, their ship being torpedoed, maybe they were in the Merchant Marine, maybe they were on a destroyer, but you can kind of see there's some great Life magazine ones, I recall. And when they come on board, they're covered in oil, and that's what these people are instantly covered in. And what's worse is that oil can catch on fire, and the surface of the ocean can burn. That happened, if you look at movie footage, you can see that happened at Pearl Harbor. You know, the ocean caught on fire in places. So at this point, what you have is the equivalent of, like, the Titanic sinking or the Lusitania's torpedoing, you know, big ship going down in the middle of the ocean. Now, difference between both the Titanic and the Lusitania, though, if I can boil it down to one thing, is the temperature. When the Titanic sank, you had icebergs, so it's cold. The Lusitania went down sort of over by Ireland, I believe, cold water. You're not going to have people surviving a long time in the water. Now, if you're trying to rescue them actively, this is a nightmarish situation, right? You've got to get to the people before they, you know, get hypothermia and they die in the water. On the other hand, if you're going to die anyway in the water, in the Pacific, in the very tropical warm regions, you might wish it had come as quickly as cold water. Because with the water as warm as it is, sometimes slightly over 80 degrees, you can stay in the water a long time. Good thing if you're trying to be rescued. Bad things if there's other things in the water, you know, besides you, that you need to worry about. Also bad if you don't have any fresh water, which they don't. And all of a sudden, I think 300 or so men perished right away. 900 or so men are in the water. And you begin now the other part of the nightmarish thing. I don't know how many of you have been in the ocean at night, in the water in the ocean at night. There's something calm and beautiful about it, isn't there? But there's something a little freaky about it, too. First of all, you have no idea what's going on underneath you if you're in the deep areas, right? I mean, you know, there's a whole world of ocean underneath you. What's more is if there's no moon out, it can get pitch black and you can't see anything. So now when we talk about personal things that would bother us, we're getting into my own personal nightmares a little bit here, because you throw me out in the middle of the ocean in pitch black darkness. That is so, I'm already going to have some psychological problems, I think. And I do think that this is why these stories fascinate me, because these figures in the story, because of things like war, are cast into situations that are, well, unimaginable. And if they just gave up, we would totally understand. The fact that they don't is, you know, it's a cliche, but it's the triumph of the human species, right? And let's be honest, a bunch of people do give up in this story, and you can totally sympathize with them, too, when you hear what they've gone through. So the story continues, and you begin to find, you know, the men, you know, as the light of day breaks out, in groups, they're all in clusters spread out over a great distance, you know, calling to each other, trying to find each other, trying to sort of swim to each other as best they can. The horrible part of this story now when they're in the water, though, is a lot of people have horrible injuries. You didn't have a bunch of healthy, you know, ready-to-go lifeguard-type people jump in the water. You had a bunch of shipwreck survivors, people who's, you know, one guy in the story. And once again, I always try to remember that the people who were with these people who survived carried these memories with them forever. But one guy in this story, a friend of one of the people he keeps quoting in the book, Stanton, has his eyes completely burned out. And he's going to die, but it's going to take him time. But nobody wants to leave him. Again, you see these higher qualities come to the fore where, I mean, nobody might survive this, but we're going to take a guy who's certainly not going to survive it and expend, you know, important energy that could be spent on living people that are, you know, could go either way. But that's the higher human qualities, right? And so he talks about this guy eventually saying, I'm not going to make it. Here's what I want you to tell my wife, you know, and all these kind of things. And it's wrenching. Once again, I can't help but think that if the person, I think he's a doctor, who's hearing this man with the burned out eyes tell him, you know, here's what I want you to tell my wife. If he's in no danger at all, he's going to take that memory to the grave with him, right? Probably going to drink a lot more whiskey than he otherwise would have drank in his life, because that is such a emotionally impacting moment. But he himself is about to go through this harrowing experience, and it's going to be one hammer blow to the psyche of these people after another. You have a lot of wounded people in the water, bleeding, a lot of burns, and as you all know, burns are particularly nasty and horrible. And not enough life jackets. People floating on flotsam and jetsam. The guy I just mentioned who had to hear, you know, what the dying sailor wanted his wife told was named Dr. Haynes, and he's quoted by Stanton in the book, and this incident is particularly highlighted. And by the way, people are vomiting because they've ingested salt water and fuel oil. Stanton writes, quote, "A few boys were vomiting so violently that they were actually doing somersaults in the water. Trying to keep calm, Haynes called out, 'Here, right here, where's the sick sailor?' And then he moved into the throng. About a dozen sailors were holding a body aloft, an amazing feat of strength considering that they were all treading water furiously to stay afloat beneath the added weight. The man in question was in terrible shape," Stanton writes. "His eyes had been burned away. The flesh on his hands was gone, and what remained were bare tendons. The boys held him up in an effort to keep these wounds out of the stinging bath of salt water. Haynes recognized the man as his good friend and liberty buddy, Gunnery Officer Stanley Lipsky. Miraculously, Lipsky had made his way, blind, from the quarterdeck, off the ship, and into the water. Haynes knew that Lipsky's pain must be intolerable. He himself could barely look at his old friend, who was moaning softly. Stanley, he knew, was one tough bird. Haynes also understood that he didn't have long to live. Reluctantly, he turned away to those he could actually help." End quote. And yet that guy with the burned out eyes will make it onto a life raft and eventually tell that same doctor, you know, what he wants his wife to know, last words, and, you know, get married again after me and all that. Now, I should point out that at this point in the story, you know, it could be a war story from many theaters, many different kinds of conflicts over many different eras. The part, though, that is about to happen now, the part that inspired me to talk about this, perhaps tapping into, you know, your own secret nightmares, is a little bit different. And no doubt it happened many times in history, not recorded on anyone's parchment or, you know, logs anywhere. But this happened in close enough to modern times that we have many, many, many gruesome memories written down by survivors of what it was like to go down in the middle of the ocean with sharks everywhere. Have you ever seen the drone footage? Some of it came out recently. They were showing, I think it was the Florida coast, from a drone above, I don't know, I want to say 500 feet, 1,000 feet above just the coastline. So it was, you know, basically taking pictures of 100 yards offshore. And it appears to be schools of fish. That's what it looks like if you're not paying close attention. So, you know, lots of fish. It's not, you know, fish in the general term. I guess it's officially still fish, but they're sharks. And I guess they maybe were migrating. But the first thing you notice if you're paying attention and you watch it over and over and over again, not that I'm obsessed with it or anything like that, is that most of these sharks I was reading in the photograph or in the drone footage are in the 4 to 6 feet range, kind of a, you know, fully grown, decent-sized shark from one of these particular breeds of shark. But you can instantly tell amongst those average-sized ones, you know, every now and then there are big, big, big ones. I mean, you don't even know what they are. 18 feet, maybe? I mean, you look at them and you go, that's three times as long as the other one. Imagine being, you know, just you're paragliding one day off the Florida coast and you just splash down right in the middle of that. Now, there's no guarantee that anything will happen to you, right? They may just all scatter in fright and leave you totally alone, but they might not. Now, what if you're bleeding at the same time? That going to make any difference? Or wounded? What if you're there for a long time and you don't go away? I mean, it's one thing to say I crash-landed off the coast of Florida into a school of sharks and I swam to the shore and I made it out miraculously alive. Yeah, but what if you stay there for 4 days? Is that a nightmare? It's a nightmare in the daytime. What happens when you turn out the lights on that? And what happens when the sharks start attacking not you, but people within hearing distance of you? The nightmare of the Indianapolis. And the key part of the monologue that Robert Shaw gives as the Quint character in Jaws is what the moment when the sharks start attacking the hundreds of men in the water is like. They can see them underneath them. I mean, this is what's so freaky, is that this water is apparently clear to like 40 or 50 feet. You know, you're in the tropics. It's a gorgeous color. As a matter of fact, it's so bright when the sun starts hitting the water that it's blinding people. And it's over 100 degrees in the daytime. So they're frying the parts that are above the water if these people have life vests. A bunch of the people who are floating in the water with life vests will lose everything underneath the water to the sharks. And there are multiple accounts of people, you know, tapping a buddy who appears to be sleeping in his life vest on the water's surface and having, you know, by the way, Quentin Jaws actually talks about this too, and having them turn over like, you know, Bob, if you will, turn over, and there's nothing below the waist. You can see the sharks below you. Some of these sailors that Stanton talks about say that they would see some of the same sharks and recognize them so often that they gave them names. One sailor gave a tiger shark, a huge tiger shark, the name Oscar. And eventually another sailor took a 2-inch penknife, which is, you know, nothing, and tried to stab at one of these things. Some of these sailors were on a raft where it was the raft was disintegrating over time, and it had a sort of a lattice floor, if you will. And there was a little hole developing in the floor, and these big sharks would come up and stick their snouts right through. I mean, again, you saw this in Jaws with the mechanical shark, stick their nose right through and try to get a hold of something. The sailors started kicking it in the face. To me, being adrift in the ocean in the middle of the night, you know, no land anywhere, no ships anywhere, no birds, no planes, and sharks all around, hundreds of them. To me, that is the most terrifying situation I can think about. And what I was going to do once is I was going to do either a book or maybe a TV series where the entire premise was based around the worst place you can be in the world, you know, on any given moment in history. You know, January 27th, 1987, and Tunisia is the worst place to be in the world. You know, the Battle of Cannae in Italy, worst place to be in the world. This is the worst place to be in the world to me on that date, and maybe any date. It takes a lot of the things that are the most nasty things I can think of, packages them together in one horrible sort of event, and then puts these people in this psychological challenge where day after day they're in the water because nobody knows they're gone. This mission, so secret, delivering the components for the bomb, meant that they were, it wasn't like they were totally off the radar. When you read the reports, it was quite a scandal after the war, because the Indianapolis going down will be the worst disaster in U.S. Navy history. But there were several sort of, let's just call them variables, maybe. I mean, first of all, war, okay, variable number one, but these ships should have been noticed when they were missing. There were a number of little things that happened, and you can see this. I mean, the Pearl Harbor attack's another one where, oh, a little variable here, if that doesn't happen, this doesn't happen. I don't want to call it okay, but you can kind of see how it happened, and yet what it meant was, instead of being rescued within a reasonable period of time, these people were going to be out there for day after day after day. They have no water. And eventually, think about the psychological torture that comes from being absolutely able to see almost nothing but water, but you will go crazy and then die if you start drinking the water around you, right? Again, it's another kind of disaster movie. It's being stuck in the desert with water all around you, but it's essentially poisonous, right? And there will come a time in the story where, and it's funny because it will like spread from one man to another where people will just start drinking the salt water and knowingly die or be so crazed from thirst that they don't care. One thing I found particularly fascinating about the shark aspect that Stanton explains in his book was the idea that most of these sailors probably did not have a very clear conception of sharks the way we do. I mean, Jaws was the big, you know, sort of before and after moment on that, but we've been fascinated with sharks ever since. He points out that it was kind of the stuff of legends back in this era, and the idea of confronting one had not been really talked about very often. And what's more, he says, Stanton says, that the Navy kind of downplayed the danger because it wasn't good for morale to talk about, yeah, you could run into an 18-foot tiger shark out there and they'll eat anything. Stanton says that initially the sharks probably mostly went after the cadavers in the water, and that's why the real big attacks did not start for a while. But that once they ran out of those to go after, that they started going after lone floaters in the water as opposed to the ones that had all gathered into groups. And then they would go after the ones at the outside of, you know, the circle of people floating in the water. Stanton talks about, you know, the incident that we just mentioned, a sailor being cut in half below the waist, and then says that there was a sailor who was on the verge of drowning that was calling for help. And so, let Stanton pick up the story. He writes, quote, "At one point, Bob Goss swam away from the group to aid an exhausted sailor who was on the verge of drowning. The boy had clearly gone out of his head at the sight of the fish," meaning the sharks, "circling below him. He was waving his hands and calling for help. As Goss paddled out, he was intercepted immediately by a large dorsal fin knifing towards him. So he swam as fast as he could back to the group. The boy in distress soon disappeared. As the shark attacks multiplied," Stanton writes, "the once optimistic boys were filled with a sense of helplessness. Jack Cassidy came face to face with a tiger shark that had been bothering him for so long that he had even given it a name. He called the beast Oscar. He swung at it with a homemade knife and buried the blade an inch deep in the fish's tough snout, but Oscar swam away as if only annoyed. Cassidy was furious. He wanted to kill the shark, but he was relieved to be left alone. As the water flashed with twisting tails and dorsal fins, the boys resolved to stay calm, clamping their hands over their ears against the erupting screams. But this resolve vanished when one of the boys was dragged through the water like a fisherman's bobber tugged by a big catfish. The victim, clenched in the uplifted jaws of a shark, was pushed at waist level through the surf, screaming. Others disappeared quietly without a trace, their life vests shooting back up to the surface empty, the straps in shreds. As the excited sharks grew more agitated, the attacks intensified in ferocity. End quote. There are many people who consider the shark attacks over several days against the Indianapolis survivors to be the worst incident of mass shark attacks in history. I would suggest that that's a hard one to know. Think of how many ships have perished over the ages, and, well, sharks are not a new phenomenon, right? Nonetheless, we have very few accounts like that. And when you add up all the various elements working on these people, you just imagine that no one could last long in that environment without losing their mind. And that's what begins to happen. And we've seen this before, right? We mentioned one guy when we were doing Blueprint for Armageddon in the First World War, that, you know, it's funny what sort of images make it into the history books and what sort of memories, right? So you're in the First World War and you're at Passchendaele and you see some guy stuck in the mud. And with all of the things available to modern society at that point in time, they can't get him out. And he's begging people to help him and no one can do anything. So then they come back. I forgot how many days later it was. It might have only been one day. But the guy whose memory this was says the guy was still in the mud, but he'd sunk all the way up to his head and he was insane, begging people to shoot him. We all have a limit, right? So it should not surprise any of us when some of these people start losing their minds in the water under these conditions. And, you know, you should also point out something that's not always apparent when you're young, but as a 52-year-old person now is really apparent to me is how young most of these people in this story are. In my mind, they're kids. The captain's an adult, and some of these officers are, you know, old enough to have young families and whatnot, although these people were having families at 18 years old back then, a lot of them. So a lot of them were parents. But, I mean, when you read the biographies of these people, I mean, you know, they're kids to me. And you're 18, 19, 20, 21, and you're having to deal with this? I don't agree with von Moltke's line about, you know, that we need war because it preserves these human qualities, but you sure see them on display here, don't you? You wish you'd never have to see them on display again, but you can't help but marvel that people can, you know, get through this, and many of them don't. I mean, Stanton tells story after story about people that consciously decide to give up. That it's easy, I mean, even talking about it with other people who are stuck in the water, that it's easy to do. All you have to do, he says, is swim away from the group, and you will get hit by a shark within 100 yards. People will drink the seawater knowing it will kill them. Doug Stanton writes, quote, "Those with broken arms and legs and backs had gone into shock and died. Others had succumbed to massive bleeding or head wounds that suspended them in another world. Still others simply drowned because they were too exhausted to keep swimming. They'd been afloat now without food, water, shelter, or sleep for over 40 hours. Of the 1,196 crew members who'd set sail from Guam 3 days earlier, probably no more than 600 were still alive. In the previous 24 hours alone, at least 200 had likely slipped beneath the waves or been victims of shark attack. Since the sinking," he writes, "each boy had been floating through the hours, asking himself the same hard question. Will I live or do I quit?" And as Tuesday unfolded, some of the starved, bleeding, and delirious men began to form their answers. For those who gave up, death now seemed a matter of destiny. They started committing suicide. "Those still lucid enough looked on in disbelief," he writes, "as their former shipmates calmly untied their life vests, took a single stroke forward, and sank without a word. Others suddenly turned from the group and started swimming, waiting for a shark to hit, and then looked up in terrified satisfaction when it did. Others simply fell face forward and refused to rise. A boy would swim over to his buddy, lift his head by the hair from the water, and begin screaming for him to come to his senses. Often he refused and continued to quietly drown himself." End quote. Now, we should point out that there are people in every Navy in the Second World War that saw actual combat that had incidents like that. And there were quite a few people in the Merchant Marine and the various civilian versions that, you know, kept the supplies, you know, coming across the water and handling the logistics, that would have their ships torpedoed who would go through similar things. There's something perversely nasty about having the water be warm enough to keep you alive for days, so giving you an opportunity to be rescued you never would have had in the North Atlantic, for example, where you'd be dead in an hour or two from the hypothermia, but it also gives you time to go through what Stanton just described. As I said, multiple disaster movies all wrapped into one. Now, as the hours drag on, Stanton says that the delirium starts to set in. And again, the Indianapolis survivors are going through all of these movie tropes that forever the movies will wrench drama and emotion and, you know, your sense of feeling for the people, the fake people in these movies or stories. And the Indianapolis people are going through it for real. Their ship went down, remember it, like 12:15 a.m., first thing in the morning, but in the middle of the night on Monday. Stanton writes that by Wednesday, the men start attacking one another. They think they're seeing enemies. And at one point, he writes, within 10 minutes, an estimated 50 boys were killed by their compatriots when everybody snapped at once. See, we have another movie here, too. It's like the shipwreck movie. So it's another kind of disaster film. You know, people are stuck in rafts and dealing with sharks and going crazy and not having... I mean, it's as though we tried to figure out how many things you could hit the same people with before they broke. The higher human qualities, though, are visible throughout. I mean, the part that got me was... As people start dying more and more, they need their life vests because the life vests are failing. They're not meant to be in the water that long. So you have these stories about people that will, you know, go over, make sure someone that they think is dead has actually expired, and then take their life vest off. But the one guy that Stanton was quoting in the story, he would not let them go without some sort of a prayer. He'd hold them close, which, you know, these guys are exhausted by this time. So anything more than the most minimum effort is excruciating. And yet he was going to see that each one of these people had a prayer said over them before he let them go, you know, to be eaten by the sharks. I mean, those are the little touches in a story like this that break your heart. Because those are that's what separates us from just being some mindless thing that's torn apart by the sharks. I mean, the thinking that goes into all of that man survived, the one that said the prayers over the people he had to unstrap from the life vests. What are you thinking about at night, the rest of your life? They will eventually be rescued by a pilot that they're not looking for anybody. The pilot just kind of sees these people in the water, and he swoops down low, and he can see the sharks attacking them. Stanton writes of a guy named Lieutenant Adrian Marks, who's, one of the early people on the scene once they figure out they've got people in the water. And it's interesting because of the secrecy involving this, they don't know who these people are. It's not like they're going, we found the Indianapolis crew. One of the first questions they're going to ask when they pick the first person up is, who the hell are you and where you're from? So Stanton writes, quote, Lieutenant Adrian Marks reached the scene of the survivors at 3:20 p.m. and what he found astounded him. Lieutenant Atterbury informed Marks that there were a great many people scattered over a wide area. He said not to drop any life-saving equipment until he made a full tour, which Marks quickly did. Both pilots then decided to steer away from the people clinging to the rafts and to concentrate on those held up solely by vests. 30 minutes after he arrived, Marks began bombing the boys with his provisions. About the same time, the destroyers Ralph Talbot and Madison received orders to cut short their patrols near the island of Alethe and head directly to the rescue site. Their ETA, 12 hours from the present, sometime early Friday morning. Marks knew the situation was dire. From his recon altitude of a mere 25 feet, he had a clear view of the deep green sea and the hundreds of sharks circling the men. Night, which he knew was the sharks' normal feeding period, was approaching. One of Marks' crewmen watched as a shark attacked one of the men and dragged him under. As Marks himself witnessed more attacks, his anxiety grew. It looked to him as if the survivors were so weak they couldn't even begin to fight back. End quote. And then there's a footnote Stanton put in that says the sharks had in fact remained a constant presence throughout the men's ordeal, even during the daylight hours. Not long after Gwyn, who was the first pilot to find the people in the water, by the way, not long after Gwyn showed up, a massive shark attack involving an estimated 30 fish had, in about 15 minutes, taken some 60 boys perched on a floater net. End quote. That doesn't begin to even do justice to the parts of the story that seem, by comparison with crap like that, to be nothing. I mean, how do you talk about no water and how that makes you feel day after day when you're suffering and no decent food? I mean, no sleep, the wounds. I mean, they said that one boy in one of these rafts, one of the survivors couldn't help but point out, was sitting there with his mouth wide open in such pain that he couldn't even make a noise. You ever been in a situation with a person like that? Just one person in one situation? Any one of these things is, you know, again, when you talk about war, the first thing you think about is none of this stuff should ever happen again. And then the next thing you think about is that when it does, look what people can endure and look at what they do in terms of self-sacrifice for another human being who's in a situation, you know, that's awful, in a situation that you yourself might be sharing. So that's when it becomes extra heroic. When some of these people are doing things like giving their life vest to a guy who needs it more, it's not like you're doing a good deed for someone you found on the street. It's reducing your own chances of survival to help somebody else's chances of survival. Those are pretty amazing stories. And I think the reason that we're so fascinated with these horrible tales is there's something life-affirming about the people that get through them. And not just how they conducted themselves at the time, but how it both changed them and how, you know, the silent heroism of living with it afterwards. And I think we have more understanding of that now than we used to with things like PTSD, but I don't think we even give it anywhere near the thought it deserves. I mean, we all have traumatic memories in our lives. Life provides you with some by default, but some people get way more than their share. Can you imagine if, like, plugging something in the back of your head, like from the Matrix, I could upload the memories of one of these Indianapolis survivors into your, not just your brain, but like have it fuse with your emotions. So, you know, you have the feelings. You could have the flashbacks from an experience you never had. Imagine what that would do to you pretty darn quickly, right? I just gave you the memories of an Indianapolis survivor. Now imagine not being able to ever get them out of your head. Now imagine going through the original experience. You know, my brain never wants to ever do any research on this personally, you understand, but I can't help but wonder if somehow the cumulative effect, you know, over decades of all these horrible, you know, memories and flashbacks and nightmares, does that ever come close to equaling the terribleness of the experience itself? And if it doesn't, how much of it is like, you know, picking at the scab continually, you know, of the wound that changed your life forever? Now, we may not have gone through the wound, but think about how upset you'd be just having the memories all of a sudden implanted into your head about what it was like when you got it, mentally or emotionally speaking. In my mind, when you look at it, the sinking of the Indianapolis is not really a war story. If it was a war story, I think maybe we would have included it in the series that we're doing on the Pacific War and the war in Asia and the Second World War right now. But it's not like that in my mind. It's about as connected to war as I see it, as the 9/11 attacks were connected to terrorism. They are the thing that creates, you know, the first domino falling and a number of horrible incidents. But once the initial attacks happen, you go from having a war movie, if you'll pardon the connection again, to entertainment, to a disaster film, you know, like the kind I grew up with. And as I said, what is so, I don't know if amazing is a good word to use in such a horrific situation, what is so frightful about what the Indianapolis survivors and non-survivors had to go through is they don't get to just have one disaster film be, you know, their traumatic memory. They get to walk out of one of these, you know, movies like, you know, The Towering Inferno and get right on, you know, the Poseidon, and then they get to experience the Poseidon adventure, and it's one right after another. It is as though, you know, the great gods of history were trying to see exactly how much they could pile on the same group of human beings. And since we're going to do a study here, why not have hundreds of people in your sample size and see how much they can take and what happens to them, you know, as you continue to give them as much material as some of the people we pity the most for going through terrible human experiences, what several of them put together experienced. That's why, for me, if you're talking about, you know, terrible places in human history to have found yourself in, or if your time machine happens to go awry and you hit the button wrong and you end up in just about the worst place you could, for me, that would be anywhere from about July 30th to August 2nd, 1945, a couple hundred miles from the nearest land in the Philippine Sea. And I would definitely say if that happened to you, you would have found yourself for that particular time and place in the worst place in the world. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet. What more do you need to know, really, than that? When Audible started sponsoring our programs, they were in a similar situation to podcasters, where if somebody said, "What do you do?" I said, "A podcaster," and then had to explain that for a long time. Well, once upon a time, audiobooks were something that people had to have explained to them. Now everybody understands audiobooks, and so everyone understands Audible, the leading provider. And, well, to give you an idea of selection, if you're ever worried about that sort of thing, they have multiple books. And I mean, I stopped counting at like five on the USS Indianapolis sinking. So let's just call it an unmatched selection. And if the story you just heard acts as an appetizer towards finding out more, and there's a lot more, Audible's got plenty to choose from. In fact, they actually have the book we quoted from Stanton's book, In Harm's Way, which I've read and is incredible. But there's a bunch of other ones, too. If you've read that or heard this story, you can get granular. I mean, there's a new book that just came out on the Indianapolis. So you want some more information on this? You want to have somebody speak to you for a little bit longer than this one lasted? Well, why don't you go to Audible, sign up for their free trial offer, you know, audible.com/Carlin. Text my name to 500500 to get started. And you can download 1, 2, 3, I think I stopped counting at 4 or 5 books that they have on the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. It's just one of those stories that it's so hard to believe that it's true. And as I said, you know, there's almost this vicarious horror movie fascination with it. And then it just breaks your heart to actually think that, no, this is real stuff. And the basic information you're getting comes from the mouths of the people who are experiencing this. But that's what makes history so compelling, at least to people who have whatever it is, the gene, or just a sense of the dramatic. And there's a reason that this story continues to both fascinate, but also inspire. Why don't you go to Audible? Check out what they have available. As I said, audible.com/Carlin gets you into the free 30-day trial, and then you can start to see what it's all about. I mean, I've talked about every angle that Audible has in terms of advantages. In the old days, these were the things that were new and unusual. Now you just sort of expect this sort of stuff from your audiobook provider because Audible is the one that came up with all this stuff and made this the standard. You want to own your books? Audible lets you own your books. I mean, it's stuff like that that has made me happy to, you know, tell you about them all this time. I mean, as I said, you want a little bit more USS Indianapolis info? Go to audible.com/Carlin. Sign up for a free 30-day offer today. Own the books you get and start experiencing all the little things that Audible just does right about audiobooks.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter. The address is @HardcoreHistory.
Hey, a buck a show. That's all we ask.
Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.